This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Not so long ago, if you had asked Michael Ortiz if he'd consider running 100 miles in his living room, his answer would have sounded something like this.
No way. No, that's insane. That's crazy. You know, like, it's bad enough running 100 miles outside. Who on earth is going to do that in the living room? No way.
But 10 weeks ago, Michael was thinking about doing just that. 100 miles is nearly four marathons, back to back to back. Michael had run 58 100-mile races over the previous 58 weekends. His goal was to run 100 100-mile races in 100 weeks. But in mid-March, the COVID-19 pandemic hit New York, and Michael was stuck inside his Brooklyn apartment.
The guidance at the time was to stay inside as much as possible. Stay in your house as much as you can because you want to flatten the curve. And I thought, okay, well, it would be very easy for me to go outside and run 100 unofficial miles on New York City streets, but that would send the wrong message.
Michael ordered a treadmill online, but the delivery date came and went, and the machine hadn't even left the warehouse. If Michael wanted to keep his streak going, he was going to have to get creative and do some math. He started by measuring the perimeter of his living room. It came in at just 40 feet. That meant Michael would have to run 132 loops to log 5,280 feet, which is a mile.
Multiply that by 100, it would take 13,200 loops to hit 100 miles. And then I thought, oh my God, that's that's a lot.
Michael had already spent a year and a half working towards his goal of 100 100-mile races in 100 weeks. He'd be sad to see it end because he was supposed to stay inside.
But there is a solution, and the solution is running 13,200 loops of your living room.
Michael took the night to think it over. If we're going to have any chance of understanding what Michael did next, we're going to have to go back. All the way back to Michael's childhood. He grew up on Manhattan's Upper East Side with his mom, his brother, his grandparents, and two aunts with intellectual disabilities.
We were in public housing. Things aren't necessarily handed to you. So you need to work hard. You need to go to school. You need to get good grades. And all that requires dedication, hard work, and focus.
Michael and his older brother David were best friends, but in many ways, they couldn't have been more different.
I'm introverted by nature, as quiet. You know, I would rather play video games indoors. He was more outgoing and extroverted, very lively and charismatic, and he sort of brought the party.
As Michael and David grew up, they developed pretty different worldviews.
He valued experience and seeing what life has to offer.
David and his wife loved to travel. They visited Machu Picchu. They flew to Europe. They set out to see all 50 states. Michael worked 7 days a week on Wall Street, building his net worth. As for travel, he didn't even like going to the outer boroughs.
The number of times I'd ventured out to Brooklyn, gosh, I could count them on my hands. Seriously, I just don't
it's
go
so
there
close.
At all. I know, but I never went.
And these differences between Michael and David would sometimes lead to arguments.
He would tell me, hey, you should go and travel more. And I would tell him, hey, you should actually, I don't know, think about not taking that vacation and putting that towards retirement fund.
In 2010, David and his wife moved to Southern California, and they started training for a marathon. Michael was impressed.
To be totally honest, I didn't think he would ever want to do something like that. I know I didn't. You know, I would think like, oh man, after a long day of work, just go home and relax and watch TV. Like who wants to go outside and run for 3 hours? Are you kidding me?
So while Michael was spending all his non-work hours sitting on his couch, David and his wife were spending nights and weekends logging miles. For cross-training, David started riding his bicycle to work. It was about 10 miles each way. But David never got the chance to run his marathon.
One day in March 23rd in 2012, he was hit by a car. There was a woman who... it was very early in the morning. She had the sun in her eyes. She didn't see my brother, and she had hit him on his left side. He fell off his bike and onto incoming traffic. In that moment, that life event really hit me hard. That was, you know, David was my best friend. He was the person I always went to for advice, and now he was gone.
The family held two memorial services for David, one in California and one in New York.
Everyone who spoke said the same things about him, you know, like he was a great person. He was very lively, very charismatic. But the one thing that really stuck out was this is a man who lived. You know, it's very tragic that he died at 29 years old, but he lived.
Did you feel like you were really living at that time?
No.
The first year after David's death was tough. Michael says he was angry all the time. After about a year, Michael wanted to buy an apartment, and he did something he never would have considered before his brother died. He looked at apartments in Brooklyn. He didn't know anything about the housing market there. To Michael, it felt like a huge risk.
But you know, these are the kind of risks that my brother was talking about. And so I took the chance. I bought the place out here. But I didn't know Brooklyn at all, like at all. So on the weekends, I would go for walks, right? And it was very cold. And then I thought, you know, if you're jogging and moving, you're heating up, you won't be as cold.
So Michael started jogging. And on those jogs, he got to know his neighborhood.
And it was exciting. It felt like an adventure. And I remember the week I hit 10 miles. And I thought, oh my God, double digits, right? It was such a big deal.
One morning, Michael woke up early and put on his running shoes.
I knew I wanted to go to Coney Island. I didn't know how I was going to get there, what road I would run along. Started running south till I hit the water. Who does that? Before my brother had died, I wouldn't do that. You know, I wouldn't travel to a place without some kind of idea of what I was doing.
When Michael got to Coney Island, he didn't just turn around and run back home. Instead, he stood in line for a Nathan's hot dog.
That is the kind of thing my brother would have done. He would have gone to a place to try like their local delicacy, like anywhere he went.
So how did that lead to you running a marathon for David?
So Coney Island weekend was a pretty big weekend. It was 13 and a half miles. The weekend I got to 15, I thought the marathon is still very far away, but I think I can get there. And I thought, oh my God, if I run the marathon, I've got to do it for David.
In November of 2015, Michael Ortiz ran the New York City Marathon in honor of his brother, David. After the runners finished, they have to walk through a series of corrals before they can exit Central Park.
And I remember walking like, I don't know, maybe a quarter of a mile, and I sat down on the curb because I had to let it like sink in, right? And there were tears involved, I won't lie.
After a while, Michael asked someone to take his picture, and the smile on his face?
It was just like joy. It was pure joy. And I just felt like so connected with him in that moment. It was great. And so I went to work that next day, Monday, and I looked on New York City Roadrunner's website again.
Michael saw another race just 2 weeks away. It was called the New York City 60K.
And I thought, 60K, what on, are you kidding me? So 60K is 37.2 miles, right? I thought marathon was the top distance that anyone goes. You know, what is this 37.2 business all about? And I read the description, and quite honestly, it sounded terrible. So New York City Marathon is, part of the excitement is you go through five boroughs, you know? Like, it's iconic for a reason. In contrast, this 60K was nine loops of Central Park. It was mind-numbing. And I thought, that sounds terrible. I don't know why anyone would want to do that. But of course, that only lasted, you know, a few minutes before I went back to the page and thought, well, what is it exactly?
So just 2 weeks after running his first marathon, Michael ran his first ultra marathon. Afterwards, his legs were so sore, he couldn't even walk the three blocks to the subway. But when Monday morning rolled around, Michael found himself online again, this time signing up for a 50-mile race just 2 months later called the Beast of Burden. Michael didn't know anyone at the race, and he didn't know much about preparing to run 50 miles. By the time he reached the 25-mile aid station, his clothes were soaked with sweat. He went inside the tent to warm up, but when he stepped back outside,
I was freezing immediately and shaking and like, you know, like, oh my God, one of the volunteers came to me and said, hey, no, come back inside. And I go back in there. And then he's like, where's your drop bag? So, you know, in these races, you also have drop bags that you pack things like emergency gear or sneakers or whatever it is you might think you need at that point. And I told him, what drop bag?
What's a drop bag?
His name was Dwight, and he had infinite patience with me. But Dwight at the time said, okay, so you can't go back out there because your clothes are wet and I won't let you. What you're going to need to do is take them off. And I didn't hesitate. You know, here's a total stranger. I don't know this person. I don't know anyone in the tent. The tent is packed with people. Here's a guy telling me to strip down to my underwear so that he can dry my clothes.
So Michael, the shy, introverted brother, stripped down in front of a room full of strangers. Dwight put Michael's wet clothes in front of a heater and fed him hot soup until he was ready to run again.
So I crossed the finish line at 50 miles. And again, I felt in connection with my brother David because that was another milestone.
Okay, so you can probably guess what happened next.
Here we go. It's Monday and I go back online.
Michael went back to the Beast of Burden. It's held twice a year in winter and summer. Only this time, he signed up for the 100-mile option. He spent the next 7 months training. And when August came around, Michael says he felt much more ready to run 100 miles than he'd been to run 50.
The 100 was tough, but I finished it. Really and truly, I kind of expected that I would.
So why go from, oh my goodness, I ran a 100-miler, to saying, I want to run 100 of these in 100 consecutive weeks?
It didn't start out that way.
At first, Michael stuck to the relatively sane schedule of 2 ultras a year. But in 2017, he had an idea.
Just a personal challenge. I wonder if I can do 2 100-mile races back to back.
Michael tried and failed a couple of times, but when he tried again in November of 2018, he did it.
I was on cloud 9 after that. But just like every other Monday morning after completing something really big like that, I get the idea of, can we do it again?
So the following weekend, Michael ran a 100-mile race in Louisiana.
So now we're on 3, right? And I thought, oh my God, I can't believe this. I decided, I'm just going to go for 10.
Michael left work every Friday afternoon. He'd be back at his desk on Monday morning.
When I hit 10, I thought, let's go longer. Let's go longer. And so it snowballed from there.
Michael told himself that if he could keep the streak going through 2019, he'd announce his plan to go for 100. That's 100 100-mile races in 100 weeks. Michael planned all the logistics, signed up for all the races. The brother, who once barely traveled from Manhattan to Brooklyn, scheduled runs in 6 countries and every U.S. state. He announced his plan on January 3rd, 2020.
And that was it. All I had to do was execute.
So take me to the moment when you realized that the pandemic was going to force some changes to this very, very complicated plan.
So mid-February is when I made the decision to cancel all the international travel and replace those races with domestic races. I didn't think, you know, because the communication that we received at the time, especially from the government, didn't deem it to be very serious, that it would be very serious for the U.S.,
The third weekend in March, Michael flew to Utah for a race in Mesquite, Arizona. By then, San Francisco was already under lockdown.
Rented a car, and it was a 4-hour drive from Salt Lake City to Mesquite, where I needed to go. And during this drive, I was very, very mixed on what I should be doing.
Michael knew he could be an asymptomatic carrier of the virus. What if he gave it to someone in one of those small towns? Would they be equipped to handle an outbreak?
And so I turned around and I came back to New York, and I was really sad. And I woke up Sunday to emails from race directors from other races for the next coming weeks, all canceling races. And I thought, oh my gosh.
That's when Michael ordered the treadmill, but it got stuck at the warehouse, and Michael felt like he was out of options. He started writing a long social media post, a sort of epic send-off for the project he'd been focused on for the past year and a half.
And I almost published it until I decided, wait, well, let me, before we do this, let's just see if we can potentially run in the living room.
Of all of Michael's crazy ideas, running 13,240-foot loops of his living room might just have been the craziest.
It was like, this is going to be hard. This is probably going to be the most challenging 100 miles. But if I do this, I'd be proving to myself that I can still get done this project that I committed to for the last year and a half. So the first mile took 35 minutes. Most people can walk faster than a 35-minute mile.
At that pace, Michael would be done in 35 hours. But of course, it took much longer than that.
For one, you have to stop and take breaks to fuel. You have to sleep if you go past a day. You have to stop and stretch. Like, there's a lot of things that are going to slow you down from this 35-minute pace. 13,200 laps took 59 hours, so almost 2.5 days.
45 minutes after Michael Ortiz finished his 13,200th lap, his treadmill arrived. And so, 2 days later, Michael ran his first 100-miler on the treadmill. Michael has now run 10 100-milers while adhering to New York's stay-at-home orders. Now that restrictions are starting to lift, Michael will be running this weekend's 100-miler around his block in Brooklyn. He hopes to soon return to the trails, where he might be able to run alongside some of the many new friends he's made in the ultramarathon community.
You know, my brother told me to live, right? He wanted me to go and experience the world. I found a way to do that and combine it with something that I love doing. If I wasn't out there doing this thing and traveling to different states or different countries, I wouldn't have the friends that I have now. Everything that I do in challenging myself, these are all things that I think my brother would be proud of me for.
We first learned about Michael Ortiz and the 13,200 laps he ran around his living room in the New York Times. We'll have a link to that piece by Christopher Solomon at onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Look, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I've never been a fan of pro wrestling. It's always seemed like a sport defined by machismo, one that celebrates the worst parts of American culture. But over the past decade, a little space has been carved out for something different. The best way to understand that story might be to get to know wrestler Sam Khandagabadi. And just a note, we've tried to keep this one family friendly, but the pro wrestling world can get a little raunchy. You've been warned. Here's reporter Joseph Bean Kahn.
I first met Sam Khandagabadi in 2014 at the Victory Warehouse. It's a sprawling, beat-up building that looks more auto shop than home, surrounded by a fenced-in concrete yard in a tough part of Oakland. I'd arrived to cover Hood Slam, the ultra-popular indie Oakland wrestling show. Sam, skinny but strong, with a mess of dark, curly hair, was more than happy to play my Vice magazine story's leading man.
All right, well, it's just a start.
Seated on a couch, chain-smoking cigarettes in a leather jacket, Sam ran through a list of skills and credits that served as a kind of resume to start Hood Slam.
I've done theater, I've done high school wrestling, I did martial arts, I've done short films, I've done adult film. I've done a lot of things. I won an award.
Sam took a pull from a cigarette, probably to hide a grin, as I excitedly scratched the quote into my notebook. Last November, I met Sam again for a profile in the San Francisco Chronicle. As we walked to grab dinner, the wrestler admitted that the character I'd written about a half decade earlier was an illusion. The person Sam showed me now was different. Less anxious, more open, and far from a leading man. Sam was born in Alpharetta, Georgia, the youngest of two brothers in a white southern town. It was a place where an Iranian-American last name like Khandagabadi was commented upon by students and teachers alike. Sam had a cousin who wore a cross every day. He said he liked the way it looked.
But it was for protection, not from the devil, but from people around him. He knew that being how he looked, if he wore a cross, the people would give him less grief. You know, much of my family around then would change their names from Mahmoud to Mike, from Freydun to David, from Farouk to Frank.
That feeling of being other was accentuated when Sam's mother passed away from cancer when Sam was just 10. Sam retreated inward in a home now overflowing with grief.
There was three bodies in there, me, my brother, and my father, but it might as well have been no one as far as the feelings going on in that, inside those walls. You know, I usually wouldn't tell people my mother had passed unless, you know, once they knew, like, okay, but it wasn't information I'd give up freely because I thought once I did, people would pity me. And that was something I was afraid of. I thought it was more important for me to look tough or look fierce or for someone to think I'm a jerk or a clown or anything other than someone that needed help. But that's what I was. I was all of those things, but I was also deep down someone that needed some help. And I didn't want anyone to know that.
So Sam turned elsewhere.
I went into comic books. I went into wrestling. I went into these fantasy worlds where people had problems, but they were able to beat them, you know, in 30 pages or in a 15-minute match.
When Sam was in eighth grade, the Khandaga Bodies moved to Northern California's East Bay. Sam found there was value in seeming like he didn't care and got tough and wild. Sunglasses, baseball hats, a beard, and whatever drugs were in reach.
I was shaving my head. I was wearing, you know, just A shirts and jeans every day. Not a lot of color, that's for sure. But it was very masculine, hyper-masculine, because it's what people were starting to like about me was, you know, my aggressive tendencies, my chest hair, you know, my physical capabilities. They all geared themselves towards more of a masculine persona.
At age 14, after years of watching pro wrestling and attending local shows, Sam started to train to be a pro wrestler. At 16, Sam got to perform for the first time in the ring.
They told me on day one that I would be a Sheik character. I would be a Middle Eastern villain.
For decades, Middle Eastern wrestlers, or even wrestlers that could pass as Middle Eastern, had been cast as Sheiks, cartoonish, America-hating villains.
And they actually had all these creative names like Sheik Osama this or Sim Sim Salabim. I'll never forget that one. All kinds of fun ideas of what my name should be. But I luckily put my foot down on there and was able to choose a name that I was not so embarrassed by, Sheik Khandagabadi, which is a playoff of my last name, Khandagabadi.
As a young wrestling fan attending shows, Sam remembers pulling a hat low when Sheik characters would perform. After 9/11, it felt unsafe to be Middle Eastern at the events. Now, right at the start of a career, Sam was being asked to speak in Farsi during matches, to rile up the crowd, and even once to use the back of a burqa-wearing female wrestler as a step into the ring. Sam refused. But Sam played the heel, the villain, and the crowd's anti-Arab racism curdled jeers into something darker.
Anytime I tried to watch someone like me, I got to watch thousands of people boo them, throw trash at them. And then I got to live it. You know, they tried to fight me, they followed me to my car after the show.
Traditional wrestling was never going to be the right fit. Sam graduated high school in 2003 and worked odd jobs to make rent for nearly a decade, picking up shifts at cannabis clubs, the North Face outlet, and as a pizza delivery driver. It was 7 years in limbo, working to pay rent and wrestling on the side.
I found a warehouse, you know, I ate beef jerky and you know, tiny snacks. I had more cigarettes than food.
Then, in April 2010, Sam borrowed a wrestling ring from a friend and hosted the first Hood Slam. This would be a show where anything went, where wrestlers could lean into their inner nerd, or their inner stoner, or their inner weirdo. It would be vulgar, oddball, transgressive wrestling. Just as likely to feature a cocaine-fueled character named Drugs Bunny as grown men wrestling as Super Nintendo characters. The first few Hood Slams are free.
It went from you know, maybe 20 people the first few shows, to over 200 people and like overflowing out of that venue within a year.
Once they started charging for tickets, the crowds only grew. These days, the wrestlers jokingly refer to it as the accidental phenomenon.
There was a lot of word of mouth that we were doing something different, and it wasn't the wrestling that people thought they knew.
Hood Slam events were filled with ideas that would never survive the WWE writing room. There were iron lung matches where a wrestler had to finish a blunt before the other got up off the mat. There were strange cosplay fantasies ripped from wrestlers' favorite 80s movies or from video games. But at the end of 2014, Sam had an idea that felt transgressive and scary, even for Hood Slam. Sam knew it felt risky. It must be good. Sam had been wrestling as female characters more and more often during Hood Slam shows, and had heard some other wrestlers mention they were interested in trying it as well. What if they did a drag wrestling night? Sam wanted a night of wrestling, a sport defined by over-the-top performative masculinity, where fans and wrestlers alike would be their most feminine selves. So Sam pitched the idea to the locker room of wrestlers. It would be called Femmed Out.
I wanted them to all step out of their comfort zone and do something different that, one, would be fun for us, but two, would let all of our audience know that we want people to come however they are. And this was a big part of that.
During the run-up to the first Femmed Out, Sam went out on the town and drag for the first time.
You know, at the time, I considered it research.
But questions about gender had been present for as long as Sam could remember. There were many days spent looking in the mirror and thinking. There was a childhood dream about a rainbow you could walk under and come out the other gender. A few months later, Sam was asked to perform at a burlesque show in Alameda in drag and came along with a handful of wrestling friends. Later in the night, Sam was working the Hood Slam merch booth. A man stared from across the room. He'd been aggressive with some other wrestlers earlier at the event.
Eventually, I was like, I'm not having this anymore. And I told the person I was dating at the time, like, I'm just going to go outside. And as we turned to leave, he followed me. He grabbed the wig off of my head. Him and a bunch of friends kind of surrounded me. And as I kind of cocked back to unload a punch on him, security grabbed me in a chokehold and dragged me outside. I didn't understand what had gone wrong.
For 3 years, the thoughts about gender had gotten louder and louder. But this violence, Sam admits, worked to quiet them. Then, at the beginning of 2018, Sam spoke with a trans friend, trying to stay vague to keep some cover. Sam wanted to know how you know for certain that you're trans.
And what he said to me was, if you feel like you can't live in this body another moment, like you would rather die than be who you are, then that's how you know. And if otherwise, you know, you're probably not. And I did not feel that way. So I kind of put it back to the side and ignored it for a little bit. And, you know, I had all these other things I wanted to kill myself about. So that one hadn't made its way to the front yet.
But those looks in the mirror and the thoughts that never seemed to go away were getting impossible to ignore. Last March, Sam, wearing a crop top, tights, and an orange wig, had just finished a match in front of a packed crowd at the Oakland Metro Opera House. The wrestler was 10 years into running one of the most successful indie shows on the West Coast, and it was International Women's Day. It felt as good of a time as any, so Sam grabbed the mic.
Now, I'd like to say, with my makeup fluffed off and my wig falling off my head, is that I've been doing HRT for about 12 weeks.
Sam had started hormone replacement therapy in December 2018. Now under the stage lighting, standing along the edge of the ring, she came out publicly as trans. When Sam wrestles these days at shows other than Hood Slam, especially outside of Oakland, she now hears the insults, gay slurs, and more. She hears the whispers in locker rooms. Some promoters make fans come up and apologize, but Sam says she doesn't need it. She's had a lifetime of playing the heel, in Alpharetta, in the East Bay, and then in the ring. She knows some people hate her for what she is, but she also feels like herself, maybe for the first time.
You know, it washed over me. I can't really say, but like there was a light and I finally stepped into it.
If you could talk to yourself as a 17-year-old, 16-year-old starting out in wrestling, what advice would you give? Like, what have you learned?
I tell myself to trust myself. It's hard when you think you're broken and you don't trust your own decisions. But, you know, broken people can be right sometimes too. And they can heal, more importantly.
That story came from reporter Joseph Bean Kahn. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, Hood Slam hasn't held a live event since March 6th. Sam's not sure what the future holds for her wrestling series, but she hopes that her days in the ring are not over. In 1973, Secretariat won the Triple Crown and was on top of the horse racing world, but he faltered against an unheralded gelding.
I think it'll be one of the biggest upsets of all time 100 years from now.
That's coming up on Only a Game. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the story of the former MLB All-Star you might see at open mic night at your local comedy club. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
Unless something changes between now and June 27th, the first U.S. team sport to return to play will be the NWSL. Are you ready for some women's soccer?
I'm ready for any live sports there is. I mean, I think I've seen every other game, every previous game played in every sport.
The NHL has also announced its return to play plans. Health and safety rules are still being ironed out. But if and when play does resume, the league will skip straight to a 24-team playoff. Good call?
I mean, if you're insisting on finishing the season, yeah. You know, we have to see what happens the first time there's a case of this virus that can be traced back to one of the games. Everybody in general is dreading what happens the second time we have to shut down. Mm. And that's certainly the case in sports, too.
Right. Major League Baseball's attempt to come up with a return-to-play plan is shaping up to be a full-on labor war. The players weren't impressed with the league's proposed pay cuts. These would be on top of the prorated pay they've already agreed to. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you weren't impressed by this either.
No. Baseball owners used to be a bunch of old guys with retrograde attitudes toward labor issues. Now they're a bunch of young guys with retrograde attitudes toward labor issues. The fact is, this is once again baseball management trying to reassert rights it lost in the 1970s. Get over yourself.
At this point, what would you put the odds on there being a season this year at all?
No better than 50-50. I think they're trying really hard, but I can't imagine that there isn't a strong lobby within baseball management to just say, we don't need this hassle.
While the millionaires and billionaires quibble, hundreds of minor league ball players have already been released. Up to 1,000 are expected to be let go. As of Friday morning, the minor league season wasn't officially canceled. That really feels like a formality at this point, don't you think?
Yeah, this is just devastating to, you know, those of us who like minor league baseball. They are professional sports in a lot of places that don't have major league franchises. You got a lot of people who are essentially having their dreams deferred, if not killed outright.
Yeah. For the first time in its 124-year history, the Boston Marathon has been canceled. The race generally draws 30,000 runners and up to 1 million spectators. So it's hard to imagine this going any other way, don't you think?
No. And, you know, any plans to hold it at a different time of year requires an incredible logistical nightmare for a lot of different towns and cities. You know, as sorry as I am that the unbroken string of Boston marathons is stopped, there really was absolutely no way to hold an event like that.
I wonder, it feels like more cancellations can't be far behind. I mean, the Tour de France is still scheduled for late August, but it's not like you can really keep spectators off that course either.
No, that's a good point. That's a very similar problem that we have here to the marathon. There's no way to control the crowds. Yeah, what are you going to do? Tell somebody he can't sit in his lawn?
Right, right. Charlie, 6 million people tuned in to watch The Match, a charity golf tournament that featured Tiger Woods and Peyton Manning beating out Phil Mickelson and Tom Brady. Was this actually good television, or are we just all that starved for sports?
It was only good television because Charles Barkley was one of the commentators. You know, I think anything besides the endless procession of corporate logos that we get every weekend during the PGA season is entertaining as hell. I mean, I liked watching people hit the ball into trees like I do.
Well, speaking of Tom Brady, he's put his 2018...
I wasn't. How do you know I was talking about Tom? Shame on you.
He's put his 2018 stretched Cadillac Escalade ESV up for sale. And he's asking more than my parents paid for their house.
$300,000. That thing better drive itself and pick out my clothes in the morning.
And finally, Charlie, a Formula One driver has been dropped by his team after hiring a ringer to drive for him in a virtual race. Daniel Abt's fellow drivers first became suspicious, how do I put this delicately, when he didn't suck. And this is why we can't have nice things.
I mean, this is just so wonderful. The human capacity for chicanery is the one thing that we can guarantee will outlive the pandemic. The guy was just too good, and that's what busted him.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
Have you subscribed to the Only a Game podcast yet? It really is the best way to make sure you never miss a second of our show. If you like what you hear, please consider leaving us a 5-star review. And thanks. If the schedule announced last week holds, this will be an odd year for the Triple Crown. The first race will be the Belmont Stakes on June 20th, followed 11 weeks later by the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness 4 weeks after that. The schedule changes have already led some to put an asterisk next to the 2020 Triple Crown. But there was no asterisk necessary back in 1973.
The Secretary is all alone. He's out there almost a 16th of a mile away from the rest of the horses.
Secretariat is considered by many to be the greatest thoroughbred racehorse of all time. But even the greatest champion can have a blemish or two on an otherwise stellar record. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Horse trainer H. Allen Jerkins can be described, according to one of his former groomsmen, in two words.
The best.
That's Ralph Thoreau, a horse racing lifer who once worked for Jerkins.
He had the greatest powers of observation of any human being, let alone horse trainer, that I've ever known.
Jerkins' quiet command of his horses earned him a nickname.
We just knew him as Chief. He was the chief.
But Jerkins had earned another nickname, the Giant Killer.
He would always be embarrassed when people would call him the Giant Killer, or if a newspaper writer would refer to him that way.
But Jerkins was a giant killer, or at least a giant beater. His horse, Beau Purple, had defeated the great Kelso in 1962 and in 1963. A few years later, the Jerkins-trained Handsome Boy upset 1966 Horse of the Year Buck Passer. Those wins alone would have made for a pretty great training career. But then, in 1972, an unheralded 2-year-old gelding would canter into Jerkins' life. His name was Onion, a homebred from Hobo Farms. Thoreau was one of Onion's grooms. He remembers his personality this way.
About average, nothing special.
Allen Jerkins' son, Jimmy, then 13 years old, was one of Onion's walkers. He calls Onion a kind horse.
He wouldn't try to kick you. He wouldn't try to bite you like the stallions do. They take their leg and slap at you and try to get their leg over the shank so they can get loose. He would never do any of that stuff.
So how did Onion fare on the track?
Early on, he wasn't really, you know, oh boy, we got some good 2-year-old on our hands here.
He didn't start to get good till that spring and summer of 73, and then he kind of came into his own and ran some terrific races, but they were one-turn races, they were sprints.
Alan Jerkins and his crew didn't see Onion as a horse that could win longer races, and certainly not against that year's crop of quality three-year-olds, which included Secretariat. So early in the 1973 season, Onion only raced in low-grade, non-stakes races. But then in late July, Alan Jerkins entered Onion in a 6.5-furlong allowance race at Saratoga. Jimmy Jerkins and Ralph Thoreau were there.
And I saw him pull away from a bunch of really good sprinters. A horse called Spanish Riddle, who was a top sprinter, and another one called Tap the Tree. And he just pulled away from them like they didn't even belong on the same track with them.
Onion won, posting a track record time of 1:15 and 1/5.
And he came out of that race like he hadn't even run. He was sharp. He was happy. He wasn't too high strung. He really had it together.
Around the time that Onion was sharpening his game, Secretariat arrived in Saratoga. The horse racing world saw his presence there as a sort of coronation. Blue and white bunting, the colors of Secretariat's home stable, greeted his arrival. Jimmy Jerkins was wide-eyed.
On Broadway, they had these banners all over the place, going all the way across Broadway from one side to the other in the Meadow Stable colors.
Secretariat wasn't your average champion. In the spring, he had established track records at the Kentucky Derby.
Second, it's Secretariat moving away. He has it by 2.5.
At the Preakness.
It is Secretariat. He's coming to the wire. He wins it by 2.5, almost 3.
And, most dramatically, at the Belmont.
Secretariat is widening now. He is moving like a tremendous machine.
Secretariat won the Belmont by an astonishing 31 lengths and became the first Triple Crown winner in 25 years. His world record time of 2:24 for a 1.5-mile race will almost certainly never be broken. Ralph Thoreau witnessed it all from the grandstand.
The day he won the Belmont, they could have brought Man of War to run against him. It wouldn't have mattered. No horse that ever looked through a bridle was going to defeat him on that day. That day was his crowning achievement of an already great career.
So it would have been crazy for Jerkins to even consider running Onion against Secretariat at Saratoga, right? But Jerkins knew Onion was in top form, and while most people oohed and aahed over Secretariat, Alan Jerkins looked for a weakness in him. A few days before the Whitney Handicap, he watched Secretariat work out. Here's Jimmy.
He was on his white stable pony, and he just happened to be out there because a set of his horses was out there. And Secretariat worked a half a mile, and he thought it was very dismal work for Secretariat. He used to work very fast. I mean, he ran fast, and when he trained very fast also. But this particular time, he was very sluggish.
Jerkins had also heard rumors that Secretariat was running a slight fever and had dropped weight. Some wondered whether he was tired after his incredible performances at the Derby, Preakness, and Belmont. Alan Jerkins sensed an opportunity, but he didn't tell anyone. Shortly before the Whitney Handicap, Jerkins was approached about entering a horse.
The racing secretary had called and asked him if he had any interest.
The racing secretary wasn't really serious about it, but Jerkins told him that he would enter Onion.
He couldn't believe it when my father actually entered him.
On August 4, 1973, five horses entered the gates at Saratoga before a crowd of over 30,000. Secretariat was the prohibitive favorite at 1-10 odds. Onion was 5-1, with jockey Jacinto Vasquez aboard. As the horses came to post, Jimmy Jerkins was near the 6-furlong pole on the backstretch with his twin sister and his brother. They must not have thought Onion had much of a chance, because they weren't at the rail.
It was an old fruit stand, and the guy that owned the fruit stand had an old black and white TV, which had the race on it at the time.
On the inside, West Coast Scout going for it is Rule by Reason. On the outside, it's Onion. Those three, then Secretariat, then True Knight.
Jimmy saw Onion's strong start and joined Ralph Thoreau at the 6.5-furlong pole on the backstretch, across the oval from the starting gate.
Then we watched them come around the clubhouse turn and come right at us for a few strides before they settled into the backstretch.
Onion the leader and Secretariat second by just a head. West Coast Scout on the outside in third.
You could see Onion just striding out in complete command.
Then Jacinto Vasquez pinned Secretariat and his rider, Ron Turcotte, to the rail, where he felt the track was slowest. But Secretariat was Secretariat.
Onion on the outside, the leader. Now Secretariat is on the rail, and he's moving up alongside of him. Those two are right together as they're moving on the turn.
And then when they turned the elbow into the home stretch, we could see Secretariat moving up and getting almost even with him. Then we lost sight of them because the tote board in the center field of the racetrack at that angle would obscure our view for a good eighth of a mile.
Onion was a half a length in front as they disappeared behind the tote board.
We all assumed that when the horses reappeared that Secretariat would have gone by Onion and be drawing away to victory just because of who Secretariat was.
And I was just positive that Secretariat was going to be about four lengths in front.
But
when they came out from behind the tote board, Onion still had the same advantage on Secretariat.
And when we saw that Onion was still in front, we got to jumping up and down and screaming as loud as two kids could scream and rooted him home those last few strides to the wire.
It's still very close. Onion has Secretariat on the rail. They're very tight quarters. It's Onion holding on as they come to the wire. Secretariat is not going to get him. It's going to be Onion. He's holding it as they hit the finish. It's Onion winning it by about a length.
We went berserk. Forget it. I mean, we were jumping around like idiots. It was incredible. We just beat a Triple Crown winner, or just beat a champion with an old gelding. Those things aren't supposed to happen.
It was just so much fun.
But not for Secretariat's handlers, who came under scrutiny for running Secretariat when he might not have been at his best. Secretariat returned to form the following month in the Marlboro Cup Invitational, where he set a new world record for a mile and an eighth. Onion galloped in a humbled fourth. But Secretariat would lose the 1973 Woodward Stakes behind Prove Out, another horse trained by Alan Jerkins. Jimmy Jerkins sees Secretariat's losses to his father's horses as a possible blemish on Secretariat's stellar career. As for Ralph Thoreau,
I don't. His Triple Crown, his Belmont Stakes, took your breath away.
Onion never won another stakes race. He ran as a claimer until 1977, when injuries forced him into retirement. Onion, son of Third Martini, nephew of Mopkins, died in 1995. But nearly five decades after Onion's victory over Secretariat, at least a couple of the humans associated with Onion think his victory at the Whitney was a significant one.
I think it'll be one of the biggest upsets of all time 100 years from now.
It's David and Goliath. It gives us all hope. We're all just mere mortals. But if we train right and we point all our efforts to accomplishing a certain goal, maybe we'll have our Onion too.
That story was from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. It first aired back in 2018. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.